Hello, listeners of Law Out Loud. You join us today for episode 4, which is recorded online due to COVID-19 restrictions. This means that I'm speaking to you from my home in Rotterdam, but our junior researcher today joins us all the way from Hamburg in Germany. Hello to you, Eva Nisiotti, PhD researcher on the European Doctorate in Law and Economics, which is a programme split between the universities of Rotterdam, Bologna and Hamburg. Guten Morgen, Eva.
Hi, Liam. Thank you for having me.
And sitting on the other side of the River Maas from the Erasmus School of Law, we are joined by our senior academic today. There could be no one more senior than my own boss, Professor Louis Vischer, expert in tort law and economics. Hello, Louis.
Good morning, Liam. Good morning, Eva.
Thank you for joining, and I promise I will get back to work shortly. As you both know, in Law Out Loud, we talk about how the law should adapt to change. Today, we don't talk about the law itself, but about dispute resolution, which traditionally involves applying the law in courts to resolve disputes. However, new forms of dispute resolution are emerging, facilitated by changing technology. For example, the use of online platforms. And typically, the innovative Dutch are at the forefront of this. Eva will tell us about her research into two new forms of dispute resolution, private adjudication and collective settlement. Moreover, we have one, two, three, including myself, economic analysts of law present today. So as you might expect, we are taking an economic approach to the analysis. Eva will explain her research to Louis, and Louis will pose some difficult questions in return. So, Eva, off you go.
Thank you, Liam, for your very kind introduction. I think we share many things in common, including our supervisor, our economic approach to our PhD projects, and the fact that we both participate in the same doctorate program. So I would like to start by saying a few things on my PhD research and then continue on with the topic of today. I'm very interested in private processes and how dispute resolution works between private parties, which is why I chose to explore mediation and its efficiency gains and efficiency losses. Now, efficiency is a word that is used mainly in law and economics literature, and maybe I will be given the opportunity to elaborate a bit more about it in the coming next in the podcast. The Dutch system is very interesting, and this is why I chose it for this particular podcast, because it offers a pioneering outlook into the two private dispute resolution processes and the collective settlement. So I think it's interesting for the listeners to see how the Dutch legal order implemented the collective settlement and the mediation processes, as well as to discuss a bit about the economic insights of these two processes together with my senior discussant. There are always some problems coming up with these discussions, as is the access to justice criticism that is mainly posed by legal scholars, as well as how the new technologies will affect and change these new processes, such as online platforms, artificial intelligence softwares, etc. I'm looking forward to this discussion because I think it will bring out both the positives and the negatives of these two processes, and I hope I can incorporate some of this stuff also in my PhD project.
Eva, one of the things that I found when you started with your PhD, one of the most difficult things to wrap my head around at the start was, what do mediation and collective settlements have to do with each other? Why these two processes in one PhD? So I think we'll touch upon that. But before going into the content of these two different mechanisms that you describe, you said that you are in the European Doctorate in Law and Economics. So you apply economic analysis of law to your topic. How does that work? What is law and economics in a nutshell, and why is it relevant for the way in which you do your research? What does it teach us for the two things that you are studying, so mediation and collective settlements?
Well, law and economics is a fascinating field because it gives you both some argument and also some methodological tools to approach your topic. In my case, I think the way I interpret law and economics is a methodology and approach that allows me to see how people behave, under which constraints they act, be it time constraints or resources constraints, and how they can adapt and change their behavior once a legal change enters the room. So the economic analysis of law allows us to see the behaviors of individual actors in a society, be it lay people, professionals, judges, legislators, policymakers, but it also allows us to discover the incentives behind different processes, such as the mediation process, for example. I find it very fascinating to see how the law gives the guidelines for people to act and how the people interpret those guidelines and align their incentives and the ways they want to act under those guidelines or choose not to follow these guidelines and behave in an opportunistic way. So in my view, it gives an additional layer to the whole legal analysis in that it allows us to have an insider's perspective into how different actors behave in different processes. I'm also interested in the legal analysis, of course, and I think mediation and collective settlement are very rich fields that allow us to analyze many different legal aspects, which we can come back to later. But I think it also, the economic analysis can give us more by examining how different legal changes in collective settlement or mediation could achieve better or worse outcomes.
And how does this relate, sorry for interrupting a bit, how does this relate to the term access to justice? You mentioned that in your introduction, that access to justice is relevant. Mm-hmm. Now you seem to talk more about incentives of people. I know that sometimes there is a tension or a discussion between lawyers and law and economic scholars where they are fundamentally disagreeing about the goals of law or the function of law. So zooming in on access to justice, that sounds like a human right, that is considered as a human right by some. How does that work in your law and economics approach? Is access to justice there relevant, or is that more in the moral sphere of human rights?
I think access to justice is very relevant to the economic analysis of law and also general to the discussion of private dispute resolution mechanisms. Well, access to justice is a human right and must be guaranteed and must be preserved by all legal orders. However, there is a slight chance that it can lead to an abuse of the right in that it can lead to over-litigation. Some legal orders pose no obstacles to the parties when they seek litigation, which leads to an over-litigation phenomenon with excessive budget expenses and excessive delays when attributing justice. So the whole purpose of access to justice is actually reversed in that sense. So in that way, I think it is very important to assess the access to justice also from an economic perspective in order to weigh the costs and the benefits of having more access to justice compared to having private adjudicating processes that help also parties access justice in more complex or serious cases.
What is then the most important distinction in your view between these private procedures that you discuss in your PhD and the normal public courts? Is there an important difference between that from this economic perspective?
I think, first of all, they are allowed, when adjudicating privately, one determines the process and the whole parameters of the dispute resolution process to take place. So one has the ability to determine the costs, the place, the topics to be discussed, whereas the court poses a clear guideline and a clear structure to the case. So these could be analyzed from an economic perspective, meaning that parties who determine themselves the process can actually save costs and also enhance their perceived efficiency and their perceived effectiveness. Now, on the other hand, traditional courts are funded by the state, which means that parties who lack the resources can access them for free and can get justice for free if they are under, let's say, a specific annual income and they can opt for legal aid. This is unfortunately not the case for mediation. And to bring collective settlement also into the mix, I would like to say that collective settlement is important to be analyzed economically because it clearly gives a benefit. Instead of having multiple same facts, same law lawsuits coming into court for the same plaintiffs against the same defendant, it allows for a settlement to take place, for every party to agree on the settlement, and then have the court address only one agreement and make it binding or not, which saves enormous amounts of administrative costs, of time, and also of resources, both on the individual and the state level.
So it saves many costs. Yes. I understand. But in mediation, ultimately there is a private decision. Let's call it like mm-hmm. that, which is confidential, so others don't know about it. In settlements, there's also not a ruling of a court. So in a sense, we also have less, how should I say it, production of publicly available legal norms. Eh? In law and economics, dispute resolution has two functions. It has the private function of solving the dispute, but the public function of producing legal norms. How is that? If you compare that with the benefit of cost mm-hmm. saving, this seems to me like a disadvantage that we have less production of legal norms. How do you see that?
I'm glad you mentioned this point because this is actually one of the main disadvantages, as you say, of this private aspect of dispute resolution is the inefficient or not enough production of case law and legal interpretation, since we are in continental Europe as well. So this is a drawback in the sense that parties who choose to take their dispute privately cannot benefit either from a previously efficient precedent nor they can contribute to an efficient production and contribution of precedents. This is something that unfortunately the legal order has not yet figured out how to solve. So the confidentiality principle is very crucial and central to mediation, and I don't think there is a way to overcome this confidentiality and actually produce mediation case law. On the other hand, collective settlement, I think it could be easier to have parties not to see the rationale that the judges come up with in order to declare one agreement binding or non-binding, but they can see the margins of acceptance of a settlement as being reasonable settlement or not. So I think collective settlement is a slight front runner compared to mediation, where I think the case is true that there is a big disadvantage of not having efficient inducing case law.
And connecting that to the access to justice part, I can imagine that besides the cost saving that you mentioned of collective settlement, you only need one procedure instead of 1,000 or whatever, mm-hmm. that it also make it possible for people to actually begin a lawsuit. If there is a loss which is spread over a large group of people and everybody only suffers a small loss, no one might start an individual claim, but they might start a collective claim because the costs are lower per person. Is that an element that is relevant in your research as well? This cost sharing so that people may actually go to court in this collective settlement, whereas individually they wouldn't have done it?
Yes, this is a very important issue that I would like to examine more. And I think it's, as you described it, it clearly is a clear definition of the rational apathy phenomenon. So we have the risk that if, let's say, one party has lost some amount of money due to a tort case or a pharmaceutical case, but then the costs of going to court outweigh the benefit of a potential win at court, then many parties will decide simply, will be reluctant to pursue litigation and will decide to simply stay at home and do nothing about it. However, when such a tool is present and there is an option to use that tool, many parties can collect and sort to say, have a public good and bring together their money and their budgets in order to have one agreement and one settlement that can benefit them all without losing too much of time and energy.
No problem. It actually has a name then, rational apathy. That's good to know. So that would actually also mean that maybe this individual access to justice doesn't exist in the first place if it's simply too costly. But that is the economist in me getting excited. So let's stop there. So if I understood correctly, you discuss mediation and you discuss collective settlement, and you do that from an economic perspective, investigating how they can improve, in a sense, access to justice and also the incentive function of law that you discussed. And in the beginning, Liam mentioned the connection with the Netherlands. What is the importance of the Netherlands here? Is that special or?
Well, maybe I'm biased because I spent 7 months in the Netherlands and I also have one Dutch supervisor, but I'm very excited to be able to learn more about the Dutch legal order during this time and also to be able to implement it in my PhD project. The Netherlands have proved out in my research to be a pioneering country in both of these processes. Namely, the Dutch lawyers foresaw the relevance of mediation from the early 90s, when only the United States and possibly the UK were starting to understand the importance and the role that mediation could play in a society. So they founded the Netherlands Mediation Institute, which is a private organization that is able to monitor all mediation quality, the conduct of the mediators, and the relevant issues for mediation, let's say the enforcement of mediation agreements. And this, to prove the pioneering position, we can see that the European Union introduced a harmonized approach to mediation only in 2008, so approximately 20 years after the Netherlands, and the legal text of the Mediation Directive of 2008 didn't bring anything new to the Dutch mediation experience. So I find it fascinating how the Dutch foresaw and actually implemented a well-rounded mediation scheme beforehand. And as for the collective settlement action, I think the story is similar. So there was a big pressure from many plaintiffs in 2008 due to a DES dispute, which I can elaborate a bit more in the afterwards. But essentially, the Dutch legal system decided to introduce a collective settlement mechanism that could allow for an agreement to be drafted between a class of plaintiffs and a defendant, and actually be binding for all future plaintiffs on an opt-out basis. And we can see that still in 2020, the EU proposal for a collective collective damages actions is still pending on being accepted. So we can see that in both cases, the Dutch were front runners and then the European Union approach continued.
Okay, thank you. So if Europe is now dealing with implementing or designing a directive on this collective settlement, do you have advice for the European Commission, either from the Dutch experience or from your law and economics background, in what are the important issues, the important elements to include in such a collective settlement? And the same thing, of course, about mediation. What are the tips you would give to the European legislator if you design a procedure of mediation or of collective settlement? Make sure that these aspects are tackled, either from your knowledge about the Dutch system, which you seem to see as an example, or from an economic perspective. So let's say the strong points, what should a procedure look like?
So this is a very interesting and difficult question, I would say, because you make me put the shoes of an EU policymaker, and I don't want to say something that could be extremely, daring to. say about mediation, I have reviewed the 2008 directive and it has been in place for the 12 years so far. So I can see that the drawback of this directive was the abstract wording and the abstract meaning of many legal rules, which led to countries not being sure what to implement, how to align incentives. So this comes back to the economic discussion where you have to always weigh the trade-offs between parties behaving in an aligning way or parties behaving in an opportunistic way. And I think the mediation directive did not manage to completely take account of that, and which led to a low uptake of mediation in all the European countries that didn't have a mediation process beforehand. This is not the case for Netherlands, for example, because the Netherlands already had a well-functioning mediation scheme and the directive did not give them any further solution or any other change, and they simply continued to stay on the mediation track. Now, as far as the collective settlement is concerned, which is very recent, the EU proposal, also the main criticism is that it's in abstract again, so it fails to account for some important aspects of collective settlement, like the funding of the representative entity, and in general, the requirements of the representative entity are not so clear set, and they can lead to many misunderstandings, given the important role that the representative entity has during a collective settlement action. And they could learn from the Dutch experience in the sense that the Dutch introduced the WCAM in 2005 and then reintroduced a change in 2019, seeing the further need to legislate more requirements, stricter requirements and clearer guidelines.
If I compare this WCAM or the WCAM, as Dutch would say, and this new act from 2019, the PAMCA, which is about the collective ruling in essence of a court. So if there's no collective settlement, the court could arrange it collectively. One of the things I'm struggling a little bit from my law and economics background is this concept of the exclusive representative, that the court can say this is the representative organization that is allowed to do the procedure. And then I always have to think about what my promoter Roger van den Berg always says about the importance of competition. So from an economic perspective, I can imagine that you want to avoid duplicating efforts of two, three, four, five possible representative organizations. But on the other hand, giving too much power to only one of them also may have a problem. So we have a trade-off. You mentioned the term trade-off already. A trade-off between avoiding duplicating costs on the one hand and avoiding market power on the other hand. Do you have an opinion on this issue of too much market power for the exclusive representative?
I think this is an excellent question also for the legislator, because this is a 2019 legislated introduction that basically gave the court the option to rule an exclusive representative if more than one representatives of the same class appear and want to have a settlement. So I think it poses an essential question to the overall design of the process. This change was influenced by the latest Fortis case, where there were several representing entities that all followed the same strategy and were competing for a share of the settlement amount. Although the argument of competition is valid and well taken, the representatives used to restrict the option of the class members to go back and forth between different representatives, as they demanded loyalty from the plaintiffs in order to satisfy them. So a competition argument would hold if parties had the free option to move back and forth between representatives in order to take advantage and push for the better strategy. I also consider this trade-off to be mitigated by the presence of the judge. A fear of market power will be probably reduced once the judge observes a non-reasonable settlement proposal. What is more, it is up to the judge's discretion to appoint the exclusive representative, which might lead to a higher quality representative, given that they are now restricted to being also a non-profit entity. Nevertheless, this feature of the judge cannot be substantiated without the active effort of the respective court or judge, which needs to be critically and realistically assessed. This trade-off must be observed during the next mass claim, I think, in order to be able to evaluate its features in real application, because so far we have before this case that was kind of the reason why the introduction of 2018 happened, and then we have no case after the introduction to see how this competition deterring feature has worked out.
Yeah, is there already some experience with real situations? You mentioned we need to find out in the real situations. Is there already practical experience with either collective settlement or the mediation in the Netherlands or abroad?
Well, before the introduction of the WAMCA, am I saying it right, WAMCA? There were many cases that actually involved a large amounts of euro to be settled collectively. So I can only name a few. There was the Dexia case and the Shell case. In the Dexia case, there was this misinformation of the index of the shares, which led to a share having financial risks not disclosed to the shareholders. And this led to a collective settlement of 1 billion euro, whereas the Shell case was also related to accounting mishaps and financial mishaps, and it led to a collective settlement of 352 million euro for Dutch citizens. So we can see that both these cases actually show that they refer to very crucial financial activity that almost all citizens at some point in their life take up. And even the case I mentioned before, the DES dispute about the hormone that the pregnant women had to take in the 70s to avoid miscarriages, we can see that it also refers to health-related activity, which is something that, again, people cannot just decide not to participate in. So we can see that it is a tool that can be used by many heterogeneous people within a country and also across border, living in a globalized society nowadays, that I think can be an important and useful tool for them, rather than simply dismissing it because of some shortcomings that have in their design, which I think when we apply law and economics approach, we can sort them out and maybe make them for the better.
You sound very passionate about this, which I like a lot. And of course, talking about medical possible issues, health-related issues in our current COVID times, where we want to have vaccines, medicines, etc. These collective procedures may turn out to be very important in the future. And also, maybe one last question, also a little bit related to COVID. We now have this talk online via an online platform. Otherwise, we would have been together sitting in Rotterdam having a nice conversation, but now we have to do it online. And you also are interested in the online possibilities of the two processes that you are investigating, right? So online mediation and maybe also online collective settlement. Can you say very shortly a little bit about that? What you think about the possibilities of using online methods?
Well, I think it was a topic that was interesting to me even before COVID-19, and now it's becoming more and more useful and relevant. First of all, regarding mediation, there are constantly new apps and new online platforms popping up that are actually taking the whole negotiation and settling process online. So you never have to meet with your disputant, you never have to meet with a mediator, you just have to have a camera, a microphone, and communicate, settle, bargain your dispute. This is also starting to be the case with courts, even though I think that Europe is a bit behind in that sense. But regarding the collective settlement, I think one great example was beforehand the ForthSettlement.com website, which was completely online. Everyone could access it and everyone could use it as an informed monitoring mechanism for the whole class. So they could review the settlement, review the terms, see if they want to opt out of it. And also, we have to bear in mind that we, there is always the possibility to issue, to register a claim online via the online court application. So this is a choice that more and more people are currently using. Now, my personal view on that is that the online option can actually accentuate the benefits of these processes, because having online in the public domain can be challenging, and there are many public officers that are still a bit suspicious against the online tools and the online use. So if we have online possibilities in the private dispute resolution processes, I think it can actually save more costs. As we said, it can also enhance the efficiency, can help people who are abroad communicate better, and they can help a hassle-free opt-out choice for people who could be in a rational apathy scenario and or were actually just misinformed. So if you have a last question, I don't know.
Well, I was wondering how positive you were about these online possibilities. And I think listening to your answer, it fits very well in your whole idea of lowering costs. Mm-hmm. So I'm very happy actually that you ended with this optimistic view. And I think everything is clear for me. So thank you very much, Eva.
Thank you. Thank you, Lee, for joining me.
Well, there we go. Look at how online platforms can make so much possible, even if the sound quality isn't quite as good as in our campus recording studio. So Louis will know, having taught me many years ago, how difficult I find it not to interrupt on a topic which interests me. So it's lucky I muted my microphone today. I said at the beginning that we would hear an economic approach to the analysis. I suspect some listeners anticipated just the cold, hard dollars and cents efficiency considerations. But as you've heard, the economic analysis of law doesn't overlook equity and fairness. So I think Ava's discussion of access to justice today illustrates this. From an equity standpoint, we consider it a right. But of course, if everyone is queuing up outside the courthouse, then the economic reality is that our resources available to resolve disputes run out. And so overall, there is less, or there's only partial access to justice. And that can't be described as fair. In addition, though, without access to justice in some form, then the incentive effects of litigation rules are lost. So why would firms take precautions if the ordinary person cannot afford to sue them when they fail to do so? Or if most claimants don't bother because the costs of suing are higher than the potential benefits of suing? That, of course, is not efficient, and that's where the rational apathy problem comes in. Ava and Louis have helped us to understand how implementation of private adjudication and collective settlement in the Dutch experience have sought to achieve efficiency and equity at once. Next time here on Law Out Loud, we'll be getting very topical because we'll be discussing risk perception and the regulation of vaccines. We'll be joined for that by senior discussant Elena Kantarovics-Reznichenko and our very own Liam Wells, me, as junior discussant. Meaning we'll have to find a special guest to replace me as host. And you'll find out who that is next time on Law Out Loud. For now, thank you again, Louis, and thank you, Ava.